My question here is, how is this big news about the government actually encouraging universities to get students to come to class? How is this not changing the way that McGill is planning?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Fireside for Brennan, the fifth episode of our At Home Season 2. You are joined, as always, with Ben and Alden.
How's it going?
And Rabbi Shmuley.
How's it going, everybody?
Great to be with everybody. We are certainly enjoying this summer season of the Fireside for Brennan. It feels great to connect with each other, even if it is over Zoom. And it is a true privilege on this episode today to be joined by the Chabad president of this past year, Chabad at McGill president, David Rosenblatt. David, it's great to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
To get this episode started off, Shmuley, would you like to address some of the comments that we experienced from the last week?
We actually didn't get any comments from last week, probably because it was such a good episode and nobody had anything to comment about. But we didn't get any comments. But I do want to say something. We are, you know, every single week, we strive to get better. We're not professionals when it comes to the radio waves of the great wide web. By the mere fact that we don't get paid for what we're doing, I think that's the definition of professionals, get paid for what you're doing. And every week, we strive to get better. And of course, it's for sure not a platform that we want to feel anybody should feel that any negative feelings, and especially when we have a guest on. So I would like to publicly apologize to Shira for something that happened last week. Let me explain. In an attempt to make a joke about the situation that's going on, the ongoing situation that's going on in New York with the balancing of the idea of allowing protesting, but at the same time, bolting and locking kids all over Brooklyn out of parks. You know, the kids have been locked up for four months almost, and the mayor of New York still has not allowed them to go to the parks. And it seemed like a little bit of a contradiction. And it's a whole ongoing situation developing in Brooklyn as we speak. Kids breaking the doors of the park. Other people letting the kids into the park. We attempted to make a joke, sometimes Jewish people deal with the issues of making it with humor. It's not only Jewish people; it's everybody. Humor lightens the blow. And and Shira disagreed with the joke. There's a bunch of kids that, in protest of what was going on in their lives in Brooklyn, they put up. They made a fake protest, and the cops left them alone. And Shira said that it was not, she doesn't think that was a joke and it was not funny. And that part where she said it was not funny, we edited it out. And it was not because we didn't value what she said, it was because it was a little choppy in the recording. And she brought up a very good point, saying that Chabad and McGill strives to give a space for everybody to say, voice their opinion. And that's definitely something that we strive for and we try to accommodate. And she felt that she might have been a little bit silenced. God forbid, that's not something that we wanted to do. So I want to publicly apologize to Shira for editing out it was definitely not, the intention was not to silence anybody, especially not you, in our attempt to talk about the issues at hand. So, Shira, we're sorry.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rabbi Shmuley. So to kick off this for Brennan, we will, of course, be all having a little l'chaim wherever we are across Canada. So I shall explain what I'm drinking first. I'm drinking a new bottle today. I'm drinking a Dalwhinnie 15. Looking forward to tasting it. Alden, what are you drinking?
I'm trying to continue my no repeat policy. So I reached as far as my arm could go back into the cabinet, and I pulled out this Evan Williams straight Kentucky bourbon. And according to the bottle, it was founded in 1783 as Kentucky's first commercial distillery.
Interesting.
Probably. Interesting. Why? That sounds good.
Yeah, we'll see.
And I'm drinking in honor of that. I got the very, very exciting news that on June 22nd, we're officially allowed to open up the Chabad House, for that matter, all synagogues and all places of worship in the city of Montreal. And in excitement and that honor, I ran to the liquor store and I even waited online. I bought a bottle of Jameson to get ready.
Classic.
For the first Shabbos, I guess next week. I don't know how it's going to be. I don't know the guidelines yet, but I know we're allowed to be open. So that's exciting. So we all know that Jameson is the drink of choice in Chabad House. So I'm drinking some Jameson in honor of that.
David?
So I was, it was a big machlokas in my own head about what I wanted to drink. Because for those of you who don't know, I built a bar this summer in my basement to make sure that I didn't have to walk upstairs to go drink. So I raided the parent stash for today because I figured it's a special occasion.
David, don't you have to be 18 to drink in Vancouver?
Yeah. I have my fake ID, Shmuley.
Oh, okay.
On deck. I have a nice generous L'chaim of Glenlivet 12.
Nice.
But it's a special version. The label's a different color, so I think it's, you know, we'll see.
Is it the blue color?
Yeah.
Nice. On that note, we'll say L'chaim. 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 Everybody that's out there listening, we should have, again, as we start off every L'chaim in these very strange times, anybody who needs a refuah shleima should have a refuah shleima, a speedy and complete recovery. And the world should only see healing. The world should see light. And we definitely see the light of the end of the tunnel is here. I got the word. I'm able to open Chabad House, all the shuls and all the places of worship. Things are getting back to normal in Montreal. I don't know what it is in the rest of the world. It seems like also the same thing. So hopefully we have Yeshua Hashem, salvation of God, clarifying in 1 minute, 1 second. And we should, of course, we're not going to go back to normal because, you know, you never go back. Or we're going to go forward bigger and better. L'chaim, l'chaim.
L'chaim. So at this point during the podcast, I usually tell a joke, but we have David here today. And about 3 or 4 months ago, he told me one of the funniest stories I've ever heard. And I think that the entire world has to hear this story. So without further ado, here is David to present my favorite story.
Okay, so a little supporting information for the new story. So Alden, Ben, and I, over the past, I would say, year, have developed a bit of an affinity and appreciation, a fine taste, if you will, for Hasidic or Yiddish accents. And specifically the grammatical, like, you know, pronunciation, the emphasis on the syllable, and the order in which a word might be said. So for example, something you might say on the street is, "Hey Bob, can you throw me a towel for my wife?" You know, beseder. But a Hasidic guy would switch it around. He'd say, "Hey Bob, you mind throwing my wife out the window a towel?" So, yeah, it's a slight difference. So, you know, instead of saying Havdalah, you'll say Havdilo. When, you know, you can add a little bit of, you know, Hasidic accent to anything you might be saying. So the story goes as follows. My uncle, he's a Levi. I'm of the tribe of Israel. So he was one time at this hotel in upstate New York where the Hasidic Olam used to go to kind of like hang out and wine and dine in a kosher hotel environment, upscale Hasidic resort, if you will. All right, so this hotel in upstate New York. So they used to go up to the Catskills or wherever it was, and my uncle was davening in the minyan, and someone bought him an aliyah. So he goes up to the gabbai afterwards and says, I'd like to pay for my own aliyah. I don't like when people pay for my aliyahs. I have enough money. I'm happy to do it. And the guy says, sure. Which aliyah did you have? He said, I had Levi. He said, Levi? What's Levi? So he said, no, like the aliyah, Levi. He says, Vustus Levi. He says, like the aliyah, Levi. He said, like, what are you saying, man? Like, Levi? He says, then his friend, who's standing a couple feet away, says, no, not Levi, Livy. And he says, oh, Livy. And then he paid for his aliyah. So that's my joke for the day.
It's a good joke. It's a good story. I'm not sure if it's the best story of all time, but it's a pretty good story.
Really, the only story that would be better was the guy who sold the Baal Shem Tov's tefillin.
Oi.
Never happened. Don't give me ulcers again for saying that story, which we discovered never happened, by the way. you bring it up. You know where the Baal Shem Tov's tefillin is?
I don't know. 70.
The Rebbe's office.
No, the library, not in the Rebbe's office, the library. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe the Baal Shem Tov had more than one pair of tefillin. He probably did. But one of the pairs is today in the library in 770 Eastern Parkway. Wow. You go and see it on display. Right.
That is a great story, and it's definitely a story that Alden likes to tell many times, but David, you do tell it very, very well, so thank you for sharing. Into our main topic of discussion, Alden, you've done quite a bit of research in the whole going back to school, specifically in Quebec, and how it relates to McGill, so maybe you can give us some details and kind of get our conversation going here about going back to school.
Sure, so we have this week some new news. The government of Quebec today said that university and Cégep students are going to be allowed to return to in-person classes as long as the school can ensure that the students sit 1.5 meters apart from each other. So we know in the past, McGill has said that they're going to be online for any people who are not able to be there in person, but they haven't said what's going to be if you can be there in person. So the health minister said today that he's trying to encourage these institutions like McGill to have as many students as possible there in person. Indoor gatherings, as of now, are allowing 50 people or less, as long as you can stay 1.5 meters apart. So what I'm thinking is the smaller classes that are less than 50 people might be allowed to happen in person, while of course also being offered online. And then later on today, after we heard all this news, the university released a statement. They said, as you may have heard, this week Quebec's Ministry of Education issued some new information. Although this information will not change how McGill has been planning for our remote delivery of courses and programs, the university continues to plan for some in-person activities that may gradually increase over time. So my question here is, how is this big news about the government actually encouraging universities to get students to come to class? How is this not changing the way that McGill is planning? This makes no sense to me.
Well, they did announce today, I did see that they announced that they're going to be opening up the dorms. So first years could come. So that is an announcement.
Well, yeah, right, so dorms may be open, but like this is talking about classes.
Yeah, so it's pretty clear that they're just taking things gradually, I think. Who knows? You know, liability, somebody gets sick. There's another issue. You know, today, if you come in from out of Canada, into Canada, you have to quarantine for 2 weeks. Who's going to enforce 38,000 students? So let's say half of them, 15,000 students are from outside of Canada, probably more. Who's going to enforce that? What's going to happen? There's going to be cops all over riding up and down the ghetto, chasing students into their apartments and the dormitories. What's going to happen? It's a joke. So unless they change that law, there's going to be a lot of people getting a very, very high amount of tickets.
For sure.
A lot of people haven't like signed leases and aren't planning on coming back at this point, given the current information McGill's released. So I doubt they're going to go in person. They're going to make it easy on their professors probably and just do online. And like Frosh announced they're going online as well.
What does that mean? What does it mean? Frosh online?
Interesting. I'm hoping to play water pong across the screen. And they're also planning on having students develop social, tight-knit social groups and have the best time ever over Zoom.
That doesn't make any... Okay.
Sounds like a McGill decision.
It sounds like a smooth decision.
Listen, we can have in Chabad House, we're able to have 50 people inside, 50 people outside. So we'll have at least 100 people will be able to meet up in Chabad House on, you know, for
Jewish welcome back barbecue. Now.
For sure. I think the very interesting thing with this whole story is that we brought it up on the podcast a couple of weeks ago when the first McGill statement was made about everything going online, and then everyone was jumping on to the idea that McGill is completely online, and then Alden made the careful point that you actually carefully read the wording. While it's confusing, the university hasn't really committed to anything, and all they're saying is that there will be online options. So this is providing a little bit more clarity, and as we continue to get more information, we should be able to see what McGill are going to do and whether students will be coming back to campus and what the best way and the safest way to do that is.
Yeah, and they're also still being very careful with their wording because they haven't mentioned the word in-person classes. They mentioned the words in-person activities. So obviously, we don't know what it means. As I said on Facebook, I mentioned this on our first episode, this comment got like 59 likes. I said, I'm trained in biblical interpretation and I'm fluent in English, but I still don't understand what exactly McGill is trying to say here. But if I try and use my Talmudic mind here and I see in-person activities, maybe this could include in-person classes, maybe it won't, but as of now, we don't know what it means.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Sure.
What do you think this means for students coming back? Like, what do you think the responsibility on students is who are returning? Because I imagine a lot of people who already are embedded within friend groups and don't have, you know, a full head of common sense might decide to come back and chill, because that's what I would be doing if I was coming back. And then also, what do you think this means for things like the library, which were normally open but definitely don't have social distancing abilities there?
I don't think the library is going to be open. I think they're setting up a system. I spoke to one of the librarians, actually, called me about something else, and I asked him that. He didn't want to tell me anything definitively, but it seems like what they're going to do is you'll be able to book if you need a book, an actual book, physical book, you can't get online, you'll be able to, you know, order it and like curbside pickup.
Right.
Doesn't seem like the library is going to be open till at least December. So basically people are going to be in their apartments and in other places that they could find to hang out, and that's what's going to be happening. Not only that, I mean, social things are not going to be open. I mean, restaurants may be open. Big question mark. In September, it's still going to be open.
Yeah.
You know, not still, but are they going to be open? And even if they are going to be open, a lot of them are closing down in Montreal. There's a lot of places say that they just can't sustain themselves, and they're actually closing their doors. So it's going to be a very, interesting semester. I'm looking forward to it. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people hanging out in Chabad House. That's why we're taking all the precautions, the proper precautions. We're dealing with health professionals and how exactly to do it. But everybody should know that if we're able to, we're going to host as many people as possible in Chabad House. We'll figure out the safest and best way. We're going to have protocols, you know, exactly when somebody walks into the Chabad House, what they do. They leave, interacting with people. But we're going to make it happen. We're going to get it done.
It'll be interesting, and I guess we just need to keep waiting to hear what the university has to say. But really, there is a lot of individual responsibility that has to come into play to people to make the responsible choice. And that's why the school has to be extremely cautious to try and mitigate the potential consequences that could happen if students are not properly respecting the guidelines, which is very likely to happen.
That's a very good point. People have to be responsible. They have to mature up, and they have to be just smart about things. That's the message. You got to be smart.
At the end of the day, they've given us the option to not be at school because they've said, if you can't be there, you're going to be able to do all your classes online. So some people may still want to go, but some won't. So there's no obligation on anyone to put themselves at risk. They could always just stay at home and do school from there.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. We will definitely keep you updated as more news trickles in from the university. Moving on to segment that I know I have personally grown to very much enjoy and find very beneficial for my own learning. This week in Jewish history, we try to examine some of the events that have shaped our people's past, not necessarily just at the beginning and just in the modern time, but throughout all of Jewish history, that big middle chunk. So, Alden, what have you found this week that happened in Jewish history?
I'm hoping that all of our listeners were able to watch the Lashon Hara video that I posted last week. So in 1312 BCE, as you all saw in the video, Miriam was quarantined for speaking Lashon Hara about Moshe. I find it quite amazing that we're talking about a significant historical quarantine in the midst of, you know, our modern day quarantine. Then in 357 BCE, even after Haman Harasha was hanged, King Ahasuerus didn't want to change the law because he felt that once the king signs a law, the law shouldn't be changed. So what he did was he spoke to Esther and Mordechai and he said, listen, I'm not going to change the law. So you guys can make a new law to protect the Jews. So in this week, in 357 BCE, Mordechai and Esther drafted a decree that allowed the Jews to defend themselves against their attackers. Also, in the 4th century BCE, the Egyptians decided to sue the Jews in the court of Alexander the Great because they claimed that they shouldn't have taken all the gold and silver when they left Egypt. But there was a Jewish lawyer named Gaviha, and as I like to say, he was probably like the world's first great Jewish lawyer. He was the ancient Alan Dershowitz. So he argued that the Egyptians unjustly enslaved 600,000 Jews for hundreds of years, so they should be paid for that. And that was a great argument. The Egyptians didn't even decide to stay. They couldn't come up with what to say, and they just ran away from court.
It's an interesting story. I think he said, if I remember the Gemara, it's the Talmud. It says that he brought up, you know, the verses where it says that Pharaoh first promised to pay the Jewish people. Pharaoh didn't just right away enslave the Jewish people. What he did was just come, let's build these cities of Pisa and Ramses, and I'll pay you, and even I'll work on it. I'll be part of this big construction project. And slowly by slowly, the next thing he knew, it was only the Jewish people working, and then their pay stopped, and they were enslaved. He says, you owe us back pay with interest. That was his argument. But I got to correct you. I don't think he's not the first great Jewish lawyer. Moses was the first great Jewish lawyer, a defense lawyer, when he constantly defended the Jewish people in the desert. So he was a great lawyer. That's true. He was innovative. But I think Moses, you think he learned it from Moses, how to be a good defense lawyer.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then we're going to go to more recent years. Just back in 1951, the first Jewish citizen from the Soviet Union was given a visa to move to Israel. But as we know, it took almost four decades after that for Soviet Jews to be able to move to Israel en masse. So this was only one case.
One guy, it wasn't the first Russian that went to Israel, it was the first one that went legally, you're saying.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. Thank you, Alden. Always love to hear from you, and it's great that you're putting in the research to ensure that you can fill us in with some important historical events.
When we talk about the Russian Jewry, a good story. It's not the story segment. A friend of mine was in Russia doing a Passover Seder. And he had, making a very long story short, it was at the end of Passover, and he made a Fabrengen with the local community, and especially with the youth. And traditionally, at the Passover, you have something called the Mashiach Suda. It's like the feast for Mashiach. It's an old, ancient Hasidic custom started by the Baal Shem Tov, and it's steeped in. It comes from what the theme of the holiday is. And then one of the people over there said, Rabbi, what are you talking about, this Mashiach thing? And my friend says, sometimes you think quick on your feet. And he says, if you go back in history, just 30, 40 years ago, or even in the 50s, and you tell somebody that there'll be a time that any Jewish citizen in Russia will be able to go anytime he wants to Israel or America, anywhere, they would have laughed at you. They would tell you, you're crazy. The Soviet Union, it will never happen. Freedom in the Soviet Union will never happen. And what happened was it fell, the Soviet Union fell, and, you know, the whole communist regime fell, and it wasn't the same anymore. I said, that's, if you were living back then, you would think it's crazier to talk about the Soviet Union falling than the concept of Mashiach. So the crazy things happen. It's an interesting perspective, you know, on that story. One person got a visa, you know, and then, you know, a couple of years later, not a couple, but many years later, you know, any Jew who wants to go to Israel can go to Israel. It's amazing.
Amazing thing. Amazing. Thank you, Alden. Our next segment is definitely a treat for myself and Alden to be able to talk and discuss with one of our good friends, David Rosenblatt. So, David, it's great to have you here. The first question we want to ask you is maybe you can give a bit of background about yourself and tell us a bit about your long history and involvement with Chabad at McGill. You can go through the whole David Rabbi Shmuley saga.
All right, that's an interesting
saga.
One.
What is it? I didn't know there's a saga.
So I remember calling Shmuley from like the porch on my yeshiva before I came to McGill, and like having a very long conversation. And then I called Rabbi Farkas, and I was like, wasn't sure where I was going to go, and like what where was going to be home base. And then I showed up in McGill, and number one, the choice was very obvious. If not for the people running the show, the Shmuley's building was way nicer. So, but Shmuley was also, I thought, a much better role model for me to be around and a much better, like, you know, friend to have at McGill, at least for my personality. So I arrived at McGill and I had no idea what to expect. I remember like coming into Chabad and being like, this building's insane. There's a library, like I'm nesting here. So I showed up and, you know, like set up camp in like the library. I was there at 8 a.m. every morning after my like classes. And I had this monitor on one of the tables. So I just come in and plug in my laptop. I had like this dual screen setup. Then I used to do computer science in La Pletzel while eating way too many French fries.
Somebody actually asked me one time, David, first year, says, does David Roosevelt live in Chabad House?
I've been asked that before as well. And this was all prior to the Montreal invasion of the library. Since then, our library days have ended. A big person we need to mention here is Ben Ames. He was like my library buddy. We would like stick a fork in the back door of Chabad House, like jet out in an Uber to Shea Benny, bring some shawarmas back, and like camp out till like the wee hours of the morning with Shea Benny in the Chabad library. But then the Montrealers moved in, so my time in the Chabad library slowly came to an end. But things started getting interesting because the first year we used to have Chabad board meetings in. But yeah, I also told Shmuley that I was I came on. I'm like, I'm on executive board. Like, you have no choice. Like, so I tried to weasel my way into the upper ranks. So thankfully, he allowed me on executive board. And I remember we ran some cool events like Artists for Israel that we planned in Shmuley's house at the time, before Chabad meetings were official enough to do in Chabad House. And then things kind of shifted. Shir became president, and then Ben became president. And that was, I would say, my favorite year, because Ben did an excellent job as president, and I was able to kind of, you know, support in whatever way was needed. And it was a really good time before, you know, the world basically ended.
No, but you could still hang out in the library, because we all know that you're not going on exchange. You know, I won the bet. You're not going to exchange. You're
there should have been a clause in this event, in this bet, that said pandemic permitting.
No. It was that you go or you're not. For all you know, the whole pandemic happened, so you shouldn't go on exchange. Who knows? I don't know. But you definitely could come back and you can hang out in the library again. And you should.
The Montrealers are really loud. That's the problem.
Your history at the Chabad House is definitely one for the ages. But specifically this past year, when you took on the role as co-president at Chabad at McGill, in what was your fourth year, not your final year, but your fourth year, we would like to know some of the highlights that you had as president during this past year, and also just some of the highlights and some of the great memories that you have over the years with Rabbi Shmuley.
All right, so let's start with the highlights over the years, and then we'll get to the presidency at the end. I'm trying to think back. I remember the first Shabbos at Chabad. I was like super nervous to go, and I was putting on like my socks, and like there were these orange socks, and I had these dress pants that were like way too short, and you know, I had way too much hair gel in, and I walked to Chabad, but I was really nervous, and I was on the phone with my dad for like an hour before I went to Chabad, and he's like, "Shut up, go find me like a daughter-in-law," and I was very hopeful, and then I showed up at Chabad and realized that after 4 years, I still was not going to find the Basharet, but. There's still next year, but at the same time, I think I'm out of the age bracket of the freshmen. So,
Pegisha 2020.
Yeah,
we're gonna talk about Pegisha later.
So highlights of McGill. First, Simchas Torah was incredible. I remember Jeremy Lieberman was dropped from somebody's shoulders, and his watch broke off, and like Shmuley almost called the ambulance, and then. Like the big times in Chabad were like the best times, but I also remember we had some unbelievable just like chills with Shmuley and like his family and like the sukkah. And like I remember there was one time where like I made fried chicken with Pinchas, and Ben Ames ate like probably 8 pounds of fried chicken that day. It was insane. I've never seen anything like it. It was like a foot high pile of bones on his plate. And then. Like second year, I remember third year, like the Purim party was unbelievable. And then I remember that was the year Ben was president. So he was in like his like Israeli like themed suit and like clearly like incoherent. And he was so committed to the position. This is like something that was always like in the back of my head as president, but like I don't think I lived up to it, but Ben was blackout drunk sweeping the floor of Chabad house after the Purim party. To the point where Rashi had to yell at him and telling him to go home because he was just sweeping in a bunch of random directions and not actually cleaning up. And then also, I'm trying to remember, there was the time where Shmuley took all our money playing poker was an excellent memory. And there was also another time we did a really cool barbecue outside of, at the end of the year. Like me and Shmuley, we invited like half of the people still in McGill. We'd like just set up on the back porch and like 30 people came and we just ate a ton of food and hung out and chill.
Summer barbecue.
Exactly. It's hard to like conjure up every memory, fond memory from Chabad house. There was also the time where I was walking with like, we had Harambe Shabbat, which was like one of the largest Shabbats I can remember we had at Chabad house. And Josh Frank and I went to the SAQ to get Mashke for the Shabbos. We had 8 massive bottles of Jameson and we passed the policeman because like back then the construction was so bad that there was a policeman on every corner controlling the lights. And he looks at us and he's like, "Let me know where you're partying tonight. I want to come." And we invited him to Chabad house and then we kept going. So there's a lot of fond memories. Probably the best memories are in Chabad house.
What about specifically as president this past year? What were some of your highlights there?
So highlights as president this year, Simchas Torah was incredible. We marched to around campus during the day, which was new. We'd never done that before. So I was very proud of us. And I remember Shmuley went to grab one guy to dance with us, and I've never seen anyone run faster in my whole life. Apparently, I made a bunch of promises during. So this is. I don't think this counts as a memory because I don't remember it. But apparently, I made a bunch of promises to Shmuley, like during the Hakafos. But I can't tell you what they were. But knowing that I did that is still, you know, good enough.
We all know you said them very loud.
Yeah.
We're all there.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I would say
twice a week, Gemara and Chassidus.
Yeah.
But now, you know what? But now we know we have a share every Thursday. So that's.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll look at the sickness.
So I would say that probably the biggest thing I learned from presidency wasn't necessarily a memory, but it was number one. Like the Shmuley was very. I found it hard to see this at the time, but after a couple months of like ability to think in retrospect, number one, the way one must behave as a president is very different from the way one must behave as a board member or a functioning member of society, especially in the context of your board. And I think in some ways I succeeded, in some ways I failed in that regard. And then as well, the responsibility just as an individual and the way you carry yourself is also very important. But then also, you know, working as a unit and trying to get a unit of people to kind of come together. There's some very inspiring moments in Chabad House where, like, you know, some people like really just pulled through, and like some people I didn't expect to be committed were just so positively impacted by Chabad. And some of the best moments were like pulling like Shabbos's off, where like, you know, people who hadn't come to Shabbos in 3 years like rolled through for you know, some schnitzel and l'chaim, and like actually were like, whoa, we like this, and like started coming back a little bit more. And the ability to collaborate with Shmuley on some events, we had some really good things planned for the end of the year, which is why I'm really sad. Like, it was the best events we had planned were in the last couple months of school, which got canceled. But like the Purim party came together fabulously. The challah bake came together fabulously.
By the way, one of my favorite Purim parties was this year. It was great.
Yeah, I loved it.
It was a great Purim party.
It was so lit. The fire department came. But the best I think memory I have from this past year was by far. We were going to do more of these, but school again got cut short. We decided to start this thing called the Busser Club, where we went through Shmuley's underground connections, got a piece of prime rib for less than market value, and I spent about 5 hours in the Chabad kitchen just preparing that puppy for a meal. And then we had a bunch of the Hamish guys in the inner circle, I'd say, come through, and we had a nice meal in Chabad House and just schmoozed. Talked about the good old days, and you know, it was an excellent experience. That was probably like the most wholesome.
It was a very good piece of meat, that I can tell you.
It was fantastic.
Fantastic.
Alden skipped that one, huh?
My dad was in town, and we were at Jay Peak for the day, and we didn't make it back in time.
Well, Alden, your priorities are all out of whack.
Cut down, we'll do it again.
Yeah, for sure.
Truly, this time we're investing in a smoker, because my barbecue's better than Izzy's.
Okay, we're going to talk about the fact that there's a guy.
Yeah, we were going to ask you about his later.
Called 2 years ago to get a smoker for Chabad House. He's still waiting for your phone call. So, no, we're not going to go there. Literally, 2 years he's waiting for your phone call.
It's really 2 years I've been waiting for Beryl to send me his phone number.
No, he sent it to you 5 times.
He never texted it to me.
Okay, anyway, David.
We're going to have to get the FBI to crack your phone to see if that's true.
Yeah, David, it is great to see that you've had so many fond memories and experiences, the vast majority of them revolving around food and drink, which is a very common theme, it seems. And that kind of is a great segue into the next question we have for you, where we really want to know, what have you been up to recently? There was some discussion of maybe a meat restaurant that you would be considering to open. So what have you really been up to these past few months, and what are your plans going forward?
So, okay, a little bit of background information on my personality. I have an extremely small window of focus. So that means that generally I'll like sit down in the library and like unpack my bag, and then I'll get up and go get a coffee. Then I'll come back, realize I forgot to like bring my highlighter, so I'll go buy highlighters. Then I'll come back, and by then it's lunchtime, so we hit La Pletzel. Then we come back, and it's time for another coffee. So like, in the span of 4 hours, like maybe 30 good minutes get done. So I need a job that keeps me on my feet between different activities so that I can be whatever. So I've been working for my mom, and she wants me doing data entry and market research on a platform that barely exists and stuff like that. And I was happy to do it. And then I realized that like sitting in my basement all day doing like essentially homework is just not going to be where it's at, especially in Corona times. I have a bunch of guitars on my wall, and I'm way more like drawn to those than my occupation at this point in time. So I decided, like, you know, the kosher restaurants in Vancouver are subpar. So maybe I would start a meat restaurant, upon which I ran into a lot of hurdles. First of all, being the cost of meat in Vancouver is stupidly high. Second being, I have no kitchen to cook out of, and I am not certified under the BCK. So it makes kosher meat hard. So I was trying to price it out. And then I was really passionate about it. I was going to do it with Ben Ames, and we were going to start this smokehouse together. And we were debating names. I didn't want to take credit for it, but someone called it Smoky Dave's. And then, like, you know, we were thinking soul food barbecue, try to get some, like, you know, Yiddish food and, like, you know, smoke a matzo ball or something. But basically we realized that, number one, it was going to be very difficult. Number two, it was going to require a large overhead capital investment. And number three, and most importantly, I got a job offer today that kind of threw a wrench in those plans. So we pivoted and we decided we're going to try doing a pop-up, and we've talked to the local butcher to see if he'll let us operate out of his location. And like once a month, we'll deliver to families around Vancouver so that it can be a sustainable like activity without having to be like a huge investment. But I got a job offer to work at a brewery, brewing beer and doing their marketing. So I'm pretty excited about that. It's definitely a good opportunity here. And any excuse to get out of the house at this point is necessary.
Which brewery?
Parallel 49.
It's a Vancouver, it's a local brewery, Vancouver.
Yeah, one of the bigger ones. And then I might be able to get, to be able to inspect the ingredients to make sure everything going in the beers is kosher and whatnot. So then that would be huge.
Yeah, well, usually beer is kosher unless it's flavored.
Well, yeah, but a lot of beers nowadays in the craft beer scene are flavored. They violate the Bavarian purity laws, which are what make coffee kosher and beer kosher. But there's a lot of confusing aspects to it. So hopefully I can just see what they put in, make sure it's all kosher, and then go from there.
Very nice. Very nice. So does that mean you're not coming back to Montreal in the first semester?
Yeah, no, I'm because me and Ben lived together this past year with Adir and Zach, and then we had a bunch of roommate drama. So then we had to find a two bedroom, but Zach's there in the fall and I'm supposed to be there in the winter. I was supposed to be in Israel in the fall on exchange, and then that got canceled, or at least that's the rumor. And then Zach is living there first semester. So I love Zach a lot, but I don't know if I love him enough to share a bed with him. So I'm gonna be working until December and then coming back. And I'll probably jet over for a couple Shabbosim here and there. And definitely I'll shoot out there for Sukkos.
I think you should come for Sukkos. That's what I was going to tell you. Or maybe even Rosh Hashanah. You are a fabulous chazan. Was it Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah? When did you do?
I did Mincha by Yom Kippur, and then I sang for... But I did Shachris here on Rosh Hashanah.
Maybe you should come for Yom Kippur. Be the Shachris of Mincha this year.
Well, we'll see.
So, David, you were talking a bit about your meat preparation and cooking ability, and so it's a big question that comes up. So to get some context to this question, myself and Alden and you and a couple of other people from Chabad and McGill, we had the privilege to be able to travel to Crown Heights last November for the Pegisha 2019. It was a fantastic experience. We've already spoken about it a bit on other shows, and actually there was a great picture taken of the three of us outside 770, which I will attach to this podcast episode. Is a great, great picture.
What about the one on the red carpet?
We also have that picture too, yeah. And so the question that came up was that there was a lot of excitement and hype from Rabbi Shmuley that we need to go to Izzy's. So we made a point on
Sunday.
It
was not hype from Shmuley. No, point of correction. I was about Izzy's way before Shmuley was telling me to go to Izzy's. Then I went over to Shmuley and I said, I heard about this restaurant in Crown Heights of you. Have you been there? And then he's like, yeah, it's okay.
Okay, I never said it's okay. Izzy's is one of my favorite places. What are you talking about?
Now you say that.
Nevertheless, we experienced Izzy's. We had a great time. And then the immediate David reaction that came from you tasting the Izzy's brisket was that you weren't convinced that it was any better than your brisket. So we want to ask you this question, make it very clear on this podcast. Is your brisket better than Izzy's brisket?
First of all, before you answer that, that's blasphemy. Okay, continue.
All right, so what the listeners might want to know is that according to Rashi and myself, Shmuley's experience in cooking is pretty much confined to eggs. And therefore, I would like to disqualify his opinion as an authority. However,
she didn't say anything about tasting food. She said about cooking food.
Yeah. So the thing is, you've never had my brisket, so therefore,
That's true. It's valid point.
So the thing is that Izzy's brisket was definitely a very good brisket. The thing about brisket is that if it's done right, there's like a very small window in which you want to take it off and wrap it and whatever. There's a whole sheet to up. But basically, the important thing is, I was going to Izzy's and being like, okay, I'm going to a true like Brooklyn smokehouse or Texas style smokehouse. So I'm prepared to taste like the real deal. And I put it in my mouth and it tastes the same as, or very close to one of the better briskets I've made. So I will definitely go on record and say that I've messed up my fair share of briskets. But at the same time, when you get it right, it gets pretty close to, if not better than Izzy's, because you're getting it right off the barbecue. So it rests for an hour and then you slice straight into it. Izzy's is sitting, being held at a certain temperature so that he can fulfill his quota for the day. So it's a bit of a different style. But that being said, Shmuley, I think you're going to just have to, we're going to have to organize the smoker this year.
Yes.
Now that we can only have 50 people in Chabad House, it's feasible.
No, we got 50 people per floor. That's this four floors, right? Plus the deck, that's 450 people.
Okay, Beseda. So we just need to buy a smoking like pit next to Chabad House. Dorms with a smoking pit on top.
How about this, David? If you come back for Sukkot to Montreal, I'll make sure there's brisket and a smoker. And then we'll have the challenge. You'll see if you can produce. How about
all right,
that?
Let's do it.
I'm saying that right now on the podcast.
Let's do it. I'm there.
Amazing. Terrific. And we have a couple more questions for you, David, more on the lighter end. The first question is a great question that Alden wanted to throw in. Anybody that knows David or has had the opportunity to chill at David's apartment will know that you are overwhelmed by the number of shoes that David owns. So can you state on the record, David, how many pairs of shoes do you own?
That's a good question. So are we including slides, flip-flops, and sandals in this count?
Yes.
What about slippers?
Yes.
Yes.
I think we're probably somewhere between the 35 and 40 mark, if not pushing 40 at this point. But I think I have a pair of shoes at Shmuley's house one time that he took home from Chabad House thinking they were his.
Yes, I actually I brought them back to Chabad House, and then Corona happened. So they're sitting in Chabad House.
All right, I'll have Zach come pick them up. You can see my shoes travel everywhere.
Difficult to keep track of them. The final two questions we have for you, David, are the same two questions we like to ask all of our guests. So the first question is, dear freshman me, so what advice would you give to a freshman, David, coming in to McGill?
Well, that's so hard. Dear freshman me would have said transfer to management. Definitely advice that I wish I would have had. And then, what was the other question?
The other question is, and I know you touched on this a lot, we've definitely been highlighting a lot of your Jewish moments at McGill, but out of all the moments you've experienced so far, and we know that there will be more to come, Sukkot this year, what is your favorite, or what has been so far your favorite Jewish moment at McGill?
My favorite Jewish moment at McGill, Yeah, I know exactly what it is. By far, my favorite Jewish moment at McGill did not happen at McGill, but it happened in the context of McGill, which was when me, Shmuley, and Ben went up to some place in the middle of northern Quebec for a Shabbaton for like the Canadian Pagisha, which had like 20 people on it. But it was like an unbelievably fun experience. And like there were a lot of stories that came out specifically that weekend. So
yeah, it was during reading week in McGill. You guys were anyways in Montreal. Remember the story? It was reading week. Everybody was gone. You and Ben came. You remember that, David?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I remember it very clearly.
The great Shabbos.
Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you, David. It's been great to be able to talk to you. You definitely always bring a smile to our faces. It's great to see your face again. Thank you. Moving on to our next segment, Rabbi's Rundown. Rabbi Shmuley, can you give us a brief rundown on this week's Parsha?
This week's Parsha, you mean Alden's favorite Parsha, Parsha Shlach?
Of course.
So it's an interesting Parsha. It starts off, the Jewish people are, God tells them, it's time for you guys to go to your home, the homeland, took you out of Egypt, you got the Torah, then it was the Mishkan. There's an argument to when the actual Mishkan actually took place. It was before the story, after the story. And what happens is a bunch of people, the Jewish people, came to Moses saying, we want to send spies before we go to war to conquer the land. We want to send spies to check it out. So God goes to Moses and tells Moses, and God says, looks to Moses and says, what should I do? Shlach lecha l'daitecha. Send it on your, if you want to, on your knowledge, on your intuition. I'm not commanding you to do it. I'm saying you guys should go and conquer the land. I will, you know, I'll be with you, you know, during that, you know, during that period. But if you want to send spies, send spies. So Moses goes, sends spies. He gets 12, you know, one person for every single one of the tribes. So it's 12. And these were very prominent people amongst the ranks of the Jewish people at the time. And what happens is they go and they spy out the land for 40 days. They come back with this huge fruit and, you know, odd stories about giants, and we were like grasshoppers in their eyes, and the Amaleki are in this part of the land, and everybody else is that town. They're very strong, they have walled cities. We won't be able to conquer the land. God hears this and says, you know what? You guys don't want to conquer the land? And the Jewish people obviously get scared. You don't want to conquer the land? Fine. Your just generation will not go into the land. That's where the 40 years comes from. 40 years, the generation was done. So for 40 years, the Jewish people had to wander in the desert before they went and conquered the land of, you know, the land of the fathers, which was destined for them. And then we talk about a few more mitzvahs, you know, some mitzvahs about sacrifices and the mitzvah challah, which is a very important thing, separating a part of the dough before you bake bread. And it's very intricate laws. But the main question on this parsha is that what happened? These individuals were, you know, great people amongst the ranks of the Jewish people. Moses personally chose each one of them, in order to spy out the land. How do they go from being the, you know, great people, the people that come and cause the greatest catastrophe that happened to the Jewish people ever? Because they were supposed to go into the land, and they were supposed, what was supposed to happen, the Jews were supposed to leave Egypt, go into get the Torah, go into the land, build a Beis HaMikdash, a temple, and in a certain sense, it was supposed to be an utopia. A messianic era was supposed to be ushered into the world. That would have happened. But this mess up changed the whole course of history. For 40 years, the Jewish people wandered in the desert. Even when they went into the land, it took five generations in order for them to go and finally build a temple by, you know, Solomon. And even with the temple, it wasn't the way it would have been if Moses would have built it. You know, the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians, and then it was built again by Ezra, and then built destroyed again, by the Romans, 70 CE. And in a sense, we never really fully lived up to the potential of our destiny because of that one wrong move. So that changed the course of the entire history of the world, not only the Jewish people. So then, how did they mess up so bad? And this is the one generation that you would have said that they saw miracles, they witnessed miracles. They left Egypt, they saw them splitting the sea, they're getting manna from the heavens. How do they say that God, we can't conquer the land? They're stronger than us. They know of miracles, they experience miracles. What's going on over here? So everybody asks these questions. It's a puzzling parsha, a puzzling story in the Torah. And, you know, Alter Rebbe, the first Chabad Rebbe, goes at length to explain the mistake over here. And the mistake is a common mistake. They got caught up on spirituality. What ultimately happened? They were men of valor. They were very, very, amongst the ranks of the Jewish people, they were for the best. But they saw a situation. They went into the land. They realized the reality of the Jewish people going to the land. When you go into land, it's not going to be like they are in the desert. Everything was taken care of for them. They had mud coming from the heavens, and the clouds of glory protecting them. In a sense, they were an utopia. And what did they do? They sat and they worked on their spirituality. See clearly in the, you know, when they left Egypt, they were just, in a sense, working on their personal selves to be the best individual they could be. And they were basking in the light of the spirituality, studying Torah, learning Torah. They realized, we're going to go into the land of Israel. We're not going to be able to do this. We're going to have to start working the land. We're going to have to start developing a country. A country, that means we have to develop a defense force to protect it. And we have to have commerce, and we have to have laws. We have to have policemen. We have to have judges. It says, why do we want that? Let's just stay in the desert and bask in the light of spirituality. And if you see the verses, what do the verses say? The verses say that, you know, if, you know, they told the Jewish people, make a choice. You know, you can't have it both ways. If you want to be if you want to go into the land, you want to go conquer the land, then we're going to be deemed by the laws of nature. We're going into the land. That means we're going out of the desert, out of the bubble of spirituality. And then over there, God says, hey, the laws of nature are the laws of nature. You have strong armies, you have weak armies, you have strong people, you have not so strong people. You're going to have to engage in a lot of things that we never engaged in mundane things, you know, in working the land. And they said, why do we want that? Let's just stay and be spiritual all day in the desert, not worry about anything else. The mistake is that that's not what God taught. That's not the point of the world. The point of the world was not for them to bask in the light of spirituality only. That was good for a year, for a short amount of time. They matured. Now they had to go into the world and take what they learned, take what they studied, take the inspiration and spirituality, which what they had, and bring it into the regular world, bring it into the mundane world, engage the mundane and make it holy. That is what Judaism is all about. So their mistake was it was an unbelievable mistake. And that mistake of being caught up in spirituality let them get fixated on the wrong thing. And that was a serious blemish. And because they were people that experienced miracles, and because they were people that experienced such miraculous things, then they were the generation that should have went and said, we could do this. We could take the inspiration that we have and bring it into the real world, so to say. And that would have brought, in a sense, ushered in a messianic era, an utopia, an era of peace and harmony. But they messed up. It didn't work. They got fixated on their own personal spirituality. And this is brought down from the Alter Rebbe and brought down a lot of Jewish mystical ideas, meaning explaining the mistake. They weren't wicked people. They came. Their mistake came from a place of holiness. Holiness, as they say, could sometimes be wearing a kapata. You know, it does holiness. I mean, I'm sorry. Wickedness could sometimes be wearing a kapata. Not only is it does something bad or wrong or wicked look like a monster. Sometimes, very, very nice person in a suit and a tie and a hat, you know, an agartel even. That could also be, a mistake also. And the Rebbe takes a step further and says, this is a message to us. Sometimes we live, you know, parts of our life, we have a moment of inspiration. We have an era of inspiration. People study yeshiva. People take a time out, time out of their, so to say, the real world to engage and figure out who they are themselves, discover their spirituality, discover their depth. And you say, there's two reactions. Either I don't want to go back to the real world. I want to stay in this bubble. Or when you leave that bubble, you say, okay, that was that. And that was when I was in the bubble. And now it's a new life. And now I have to be here. The Rebbe says that's the same mistake that this Paragla made. And we should never make that mistake. What we have to do is we have to take the inspiration that we had and bring it into everyday life and spread the inspiration. And you know, if you know an Aleph? If you know an Aleph, what do? You teach an Aleph. And that's the message of one of the many messages of this week's parsha.
Thank you, Rabbi Shmuley.
Chaim.
Chaim. Always a privilege to be able to hear from you as you bring wisdom from the Torah. Moving on to the weekly Nigun, the Pan for the Soul, always a segment that we look forward to trying to ignite that deep spirituality within us. So Shmuley, which Nigun are we going to showcase this week?
You know, before we introduce the Nigun of the week, you said a story, Ben, last week. And I was rethinking about the story over Shabbos, and I'm like, it's an amazing story, and I want to repeat it. You know, you were going through a difficult time that week in dealing with something, and you sang a niggun. At that moment, when you were singing that niggun, you felt connected to, you felt an unbelievable burst of spirituality and inspiration. So first of all, it's an amazing story. I mean, I don't know how it just went over my head last week. We could have brained on that the rest of the evening. But I think that is what it means. A niggun is the pen of the soul. There are certain times in our life when we sit down and when we sing a niggun, right? We have this burst of spirituality sometimes deeper than if we study some words of Torah and some words of wisdom, is because sometimes song comes to the deepest part of ourselves, which could the part of our neshama, which comes to a deep part of heaven called Heichal Negina, the chamber of song. So this is you actually told a story about the point of a niggun. So on that note, we'll introduce a niggun. It's called Niggun Rikud. This niggun Rikud, there's a lot of nigunim Rikud. Rikud means dance. It's a niggun that's a song that's a lively song from the Chassidim of Nikolayev. Nikolayev was a city in Ukraine, and it happens to be that the Rebbe's mother was from Nikolayev. The Rebbe's grandfather was the Rav of Nikolayev, and the Rebbe's father was the Rav of Nikolayev for a while until he moved to the bigger city. And if I'm not mistaken, the Rebbe was born in Nikolayev, city of Nikolayev. And the Rebbe always had felt a special connection to the Hasidic tunes of the Hasidim from Nikolayev. And even, there's many stories about the Rebbe saying stories from Hasidim of Nikolayev. So this niggun is a niggun from those Hasidim. And the Rebbe used to sing this niggun quite often by Farbrengens. And it was always a moment, one of those pivotal moments of spirituality in 770 by Farbrengens. Usually it would get very, very freilich, very happy. Sometimes in the early 50s and 60s, many times when they would sing this niggun in 770 by Farbrengens, the Rebbe would even get up and from his chair and start dancing. So it's a very inspiring and very joyful niggun. So on that note, here's the niggun.
And that brings us to the close of this episode of the Fireside for Brangen. It has been an absolute pleasure to be able to be with you.
Before we conclude, I just want to let everybody know that next Tuesday on June 23rd, there's going to be an interesting event, and it's going to be online. Most events today are online till things get back to normal. The Rebbe's Yahrzeit anniversary of passing is, next Thursday. So in line of, with making a public a gathering, an event in Montreal, which is going to be, online, we're doing an event called The Rebbe on Equality and Race. Two scholars are going to be discussing the Rebbe's vision, because we all know the Rebbe had many interactions with a lot of different people and a lot of different leaders from all walks of life. And the Rebbe said many interesting things on the Rebbe had a view in his teachings and his outlook and things, the way he acted on, with race relations. And I really think that these scholars that are going to, sort of talk about the Rebbe's view will give us very deep insight in sort of being able to, each one of us, go into ourselves and see where we can do, where we can be better. Where we could do better. So I definitely, the Rebbe was an inspiration for this. I think it's worthwhile. It's going to be at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday, from 7:30 to 9. I will send out a link. If for those of you who don't get the link, it will be live streamed on ChabadMcGill.com. It's going to be a live stream. So I definitely encourage everybody to tune in. It'll be definitely a worthwhile event.
Absolutely. And all the information can be found on Facebook. All the Chabad houses in Montreal are co-sponsoring the event. So all the information for that event can be found on Facebook. With that brings us to the close of this extremely enjoyable podcast. It's been a privilege to be with you. Thank you, David, for coming on our show. It was great to have you. And we look forward to joining you next week for another for Brandon.
David, we're looking forward to seeing you in Montreal.
Bye.
L'chaim.
Bye, everyone.